Ketterdam.
What will happen when we get there?
He asked Geordie.
I'll get a job as a runner at the exchange, then a clerk. I'll become a stockholder and then a proper merchant. And then I'll make my fortune.
What about me?
You will go to school.
Why won't you go to school?
Geordie had scoffed. I'm too old for school. Too smart, too. First few days in the city were all Geordie had promised. They'd walked along the great curve of the harbors known as the Lid, then down East Stave to see all the gambling palaces. They didn't venture too far south, where they'd been warned the streets grew dangerous. They let rooms in a tidy little boarding house not far from the exchange and tried every new food they saw, stuffing themselves sick on quince candy. Kaz liked the little omelet stands where you could choose what you liked to put in them. Each morning, Geordie went to the exchange to look for work and told Kaz to stay in his room. Ketterdam wasn't safe for children on their own. There were thieves and pickpockets and even men who would snap up little boys and sell them to the highest bidder. So Kaz stayed inside. He pushed a chair up to the basin and climbed on it so he could see himself in the mirror as he tried to make coins disappear, just as he'd seen a magician do, performing in front of one of the gambling halls. Kaz could have watched him for hours, but eventually Geordie had dragged him away. The card tricks had been good, but the disappearing coin kept him up at night. How had the magician done it? It had been there one moment, gone the next. The disaster began with a wind-up dog. Geordie had come home hungry and irritable, frustrated after another wasted day. They say they have no jobs, but they mean they have no jobs for a boy like me. Everyone there is someone's cousin or brother or best friend's son. Kaz hadn't been in a mood to try to cheer him up. He was grouchy after so many hours indoors with nothing but coins and cards to keep him company. He wanted to go down to East Stave to find the magician. In the years after, Kaz would always wonder what might have happened if Geordie hadn't indulged him. If they'd gone to the harbor to look at boats instead, or if they'd simply been walking on the other side of the canal. He wanted to believe that might have made the difference. But the older he got, the more he doubted it would have mattered at all. They'd passed the green riot of the Emerald Palace, and right next door, in front of the gold strike, there'd been a boy selling little mechanical dogs. The toys wound up with a bronze key and waddled on stiff legs, tin ears flapping. Kaz had crouched down, turning all the keys, trying to get all the dogs waddling at the same time. And the boy selling them had struck up a conversation with Geordie. As it turned out, he was from Lidge, not two towns over from where Kaz and Geordie had been raised, and he knew a man with jobs open for runners, not at the exchange, but at an office just down the street. Geordie should come by the next morning, he said, and they could go chat with him together. He'd been hoping to land a job as a runner, too. On the way home, Geordie had bought them each a hot chocolate, not just one, to share. Our luck is changing, he said as they curled their hands around the steaming cups, feet dangling over a little bridge, the lights of the Stave playing over the water. Kaz had looked down at their reflections on the bright surface of the canal and thought, I feel lucky now. The boy who sold the mechanical dogs was named Philip, and the man he knew was Jacob Hertzoon, a minor mercher who owned a small coffee house near the exchange, where he arranged for low-level investors to split stakes in trade voyages passing through Kerch. You should see this place, Geordie had crowed to Kaz upon arriving home late that night. There are people there at every hour, talking and trading news, buying and selling shares and futures, ordinary people, butchers and bakers and dock workers. Mr. Hertzun says any man can become rich. All he needs is luck and the right friends. The next week was like a happy dream. Jordy and Philip worked for Mr. Hertzun as runners, carrying messages to and from the dock and occasionally placing orders for him at the exchange or other trading offices. While they were working, Kaz was allowed to stay at the coffee house. The man who filled drink orders from behind the bar would let him sit up on the counter and practice his magic tricks, and gave Kaz all the hot chocolate he could drink. They were invited to the Hertzun home for dinner. A grand house on the Silverstraat with a blue front door and white lace curtains in the windows. Mr. Hertzun was a big man with a ruddy, friendly face and tufty gray sideburns. His wife, Margit, pinched Kaz's cheeks and fed him hot spot made with smoked sausage. And he'd played in the kitchen with their daughter, Saskia. She was 10 years old, and Kaz thought she was the most beautiful girl he'd ever seen. He and Jordy stayed late into the night singing songs while Margit played the piano, their big silver dog thumping its tail in hapless rhythm. It was the best Kaz had felt since his father died. Mr. Hertzun even let Jordy put tiny sums down on company stocks. Jordy wanted to invest more, but Mr. Hertzun always advised caution. Small steps, lad. Small steps. Things got even better when Mr. Hertzun's friend returned from Novia Zem. He was the captain of a Kirch trader, and it seemed he had crossed paths with a sugar farmer in a Zemeni port. The farmer had been in his cups, moaning about how his and his neighbor's cane field had been flooded. Right now, sugar prices were low. But when people found out how hard it would be to get sugar in the coming months, prices would soar. Mr. Hertzun's friend intended to buy up all the sugar he could before the news reached Ketterdam. "That seems like cheating," Kaz had whispered to Jordy. "It isn't cheating," Jordy had snorted. "It's just good business. And how are ordinary people supposed to move up in the world without a little extra help?" Mr. Hertzun had Jordy and Philip place the orders with 3 separate offices to make sure such a large purchase didn't garner unwanted attention. News of the failed crop came in, and sitting in the coffee house, the boys had watched the prices on the chalkboard rise, trying to contain their glee. When Mr. Hertzun thought the shares had gone as high as they could go, he sent Jordy and Philip to sell out and collect. They'd returned to the coffee house, and Mr. Hertzun had handed both of them their profits straight from his safe. "What did I tell you?" Jordy said to Kaz as they headed out into the Ketterdam night. "Luck and good friends." Only a few days later, Mr. Hertzun told them of another tip he'd received from his friend, the captain, who'd gotten similar word on the next crop of Jurda. "The rains are hitting everyone hard this year," Mr. Hertzun said. "But this time, not only the fields were destroyed, but the warehouses down by the docks in Eames. This is going to be big money, and I intend to go in heavy."
"And we should too," said Philip.
Mr. Hertzun had frowned.
"I'm afraid this isn't a deal for you boys. The minimum investment is far too high for either of you. But there will be more trades to come."
Philip had been furious. He'd yelled at Mr. Hertzun, told him it wasn't fair. He said Mr. Hertzun was just like the merchants at the exchange, hoarding all the riches for himself, and called Mr. Hertzun names that had made Kaz cringe. When he stormed out, everyone at the coffee house had stared at Mr. Hertzun's red, embarrassed face. He'd gone back to his office and slouched down in his chair.
I can't help the way business is done. The men running the trade want only big investors, people who can support the risk."
Jordy and Kaz had stood there, unsure of what to do.
"Are you angry with me too?"
asked Mr. Hertzun. "Of course not," they assured him. Philip was the one who was being unfair.
"I understand why he's angry," said Mr. Hertzun. "Opportunities like this one don't come along often, but there's nothing to be done."
"I have money," said Jordy.
Mr. Hertzun had smiled indulgently.
Geordi, you're a good lad, and someday I have no doubt you'll be a king of the exchange. But you don't have the kind of funds these investors require. Geordi's chin had gone up.
I do. From the sale of my father's farm.
And I expect it's all you and Kaz have to live on. That's not something to be risked on a trade, no matter how certain the outcome. A child your age has no business. I'm not a child. If it's a good opportunity, I want to take it. Kaz would always remember that moment, when he'd seen greed take hold of his brother, an invisible hand guiding him onward. The lever at work. Mr. Herzoon had taken a lot of convincing. They'd all gone back to the Zelferstrat house and discussed it well into the night. Kaz had fallen asleep with his head on the silver dog's side, and Saskia's red ribbon clutched in his hand. When Geordi finally roused him, the candles had burned low. And it was already morning. Mr. Herzoon had asked his business partner to come over and draw up a contract for a loan from Geordi. Because of his age, Geordi would loan Mr. Herzoon the money, and Mr. Herzoon would place the trade. Margit gave them milk tea and warm pancakes with sour cream and jam. Then they'd all walked to the bank that held the funds from the sale of the farm, and Geordi signed them over. Mr. Herzoon insisted on escorting them back to their boarding house, and he'd hugged them at the door. He handed the loan agreement to Geordi and warned him to keep it safe. "Now, Geordi," he said, "there is only a small chance that this trade will go bad, but there is always a chance. If it does, I'm relying on you not to use that document to call in your loan. We both must take the risk together. I'm trusting you." Geordi had beamed. "The deal is the deal," he said. "The deal is the deal," said Mr. Herzoon proudly, and they shook hands like proper merchants. Mr. Herzoon handed Geordi a thick roll of Kruge. "For a fine dinner to celebrate. Come back to the coffee house a week from today, and we'll watch the prices rise together." That week they'd played Ritterspell and Spitschker at the arcades on the Lid. They bought Geordi a fine new coat and Kaz a new pair of soft leather boots. They'd eaten waffles and fried potatoes, and Geordi had purchased every novel he craved at a bookshop in Wigenstraat. When the week was over, they'd walked hand in hand to the coffee house. It was empty. The front door was locked and bolted. When they pressed their faces to the dark windows, they saw that everything was gone. The tables and chairs and big copper urns. The chalkboard where the figures for the day's trades had been posted. "Do we have the wrong corner?" asked Kaz. But they knew they didn't. In nervous silence, they walked to the house on Zelverstraat. No one answered their knock on the bright blue door. "They've just gone out for a while," said Geordi. They waited on the steps for hours, until the sun began to set. No one came or went. No candles were lit in the windows. Finally, Geordi worked up the courage to knock on a neighbor's door.
"Yes," said the maid who answered in her little white cap. "Do you know where the family next door has gone, the Herzoons?"
The maid's brow furrowed.
"I think they were just visiting for a time from Zierfort."
"No," Geordi said. "They've lived here for years.
The maid shook her head.
"That house stood empty for nearly a year after the last family moved away. It was only rented a few weeks ago."
"But..."
She closed the door in his face. Kaz and Geordi said nothing to each other. Not on the walk home, or as they climbed the stairs to their little room in the boarding house. They sat in the growing gloom for a long time. Voices floated back to them from the canal below, as people went about their evening business.
"Something happened to them," Geordi said at last. "There was an accident or an emergency. He'll write soon. He'll send for us."
That night, Kaz took Saskia's red ribbon from beneath his pillow. He rolled it into a neat spiral and clutched it in his palm. He lay in bed and tried to pray, but all he could think about was the magician's coin.
There? and then gone.
19. Matthias. It was too much. He hadn't anticipated how difficult it would be to see his homeland for the first time in so long. He'd had over a week aboard the Ferrolined to prepare, but his head had been full of the path he'd chosen, of Nina, of the cruel magic that had taken him from his prison cell and placed him on a boat speeding north beneath a limitless sky. Still bound, not just by shackles, but by the burden of what he was about to do. He got his first glimpse of the northern coast late in the afternoon, but Specht decided to wait until dusk to make land in hopes the twilight would lend them some cover. There were whaling villages along the shore, and no one was eager to be spotted. Despite their cover as trappers, the dregs were still a conspicuous group. They spent the night on the ship. At dawn the next morning, Nina had found him assembling the cold weather gear Jesper and Inej had distributed. Matthias was impressed by Inej's resilience. Though she still had circles beneath her eyes, she moved without stiffness, and if she was in pain, she hid it well. Nina held up a key.
Kaz sent me to remove your shackles.
Are you going to lock me in again at night?
That's up to Kaz. And you, I suppose. Have a seat.
Just give me the key.
Nina cleared her throat.
He also wants me to tailor you.
What? Why?
The thought of Nina altering his appearance with her witchcraft was intolerable.
We're in Fjerda now. He wants you looking a little less like yourself, just in case.
Do you know how big this country is? The chance that...
The odds of you being recognized will be considerably higher at the ice court, and I can't make changes to your appearance all at once.
Why?
I'm not that good a tailor. It's part of all corporalki training now, but I just didn't have an affinity for it.
Matthias snorted.
What?
She asked.
I've never heard you admit you're not good at something.
Well, it happens so rarely.
He was horrified to find his lips curling in a smile, but it was easy enough to quell when he thought of his face being changed.
What does Brekker want you to do to me?
Nothing radical. I'll change your eye color, your hair, what you have of it. It won't be permanent.
I don't want this. And he thought, I don't want you near me.
It won't take long, and it will be painless. But if you want to argue about it with Kaz...
Fine, he said, steeling himself.
It was pointless to argue with Brekker. Not when he could simply taunt Matthias with the promise of the pardon. Matthias picked up a bucket, flipped it over, and sat down.
Can I have the key now?
She handed it over to him, and he unshackled his wrists as she rooted around in a box she'd brought over. It had a handle and several little drawers stuffed with powders and pigments in tiny jars. She extracted a pot of something black from a drawer.
What is it?
Black antimony.
She stepped close to him, tilting his chin back with the tip of her finger.
Unclench your jaw, Matthias. You're going to grind your teeth down to nothing.
He crossed his arms. She started shaking some of the antimony over his scalp and gave a rueful sigh.
Why does the brave Druskella, Matthias Helvar, eat no meat?
She asked in a theatrical voice as she worked.
"'Tis a sad story indeed, my child. His teeth were winnowed away by a vexatious Grisha, and now he can eat only pudding.'
"'Stop that,' he grumbled.
"'What? Keep your head tilted back.
"'What are you doing?'
"'Darkening your brows and lashes. You know, the way girls do before a party.'
He must have grimaced because she burst out laughing.
"'A look on your face.'
She leaned in. The waves of her brown hair brushing against his cheeks as she bled the color from the antimony into his brows. Her hand cupped his cheek.
Shut your eyes,
she murmured. Her thumbs moved over his lashes, and he realized he was holding his breath.
You don't smell like roses anymore, he said, then wanted to kick himself. He shouldn't be noticing her scent.
I probably smell like boat.
No.
She smelled sweet, perfect, like...
Toffee?
Her eyes slid away guiltily.
Kaz said to pack what we needed for the journey. A girl has to eat.
She reached into her pocket and drew out a bag of toffees.
Want one?
Yes, Matthias thought. No. She shrugged and popped one in her mouth. Her eyes rolled back and she sighed happily.
So good.
It was a humiliating epiphany, but he knew he could have watched her eat all day. This was one of the things he'd liked best about Nina. She savored everything, whether it was a toffee or cold water from a stream or dried reindeer meat.
Eyes now,
she said around the candy as she pulled a tiny bottle from her case.
You'll have to keep them open.
What is that? He asked nervously.
A tincture developed by a Grisha named Jenya Safin. It's the safest way to change eye color.
Again she leaned in. Her cheeks were rosy from the cold, her mouth slightly open. Her lips were bare inches from his. If he sat up straighter, they'd be kissing.
You have to look at me, she instructed.
I am, he thought. He shifted his gaze to hers. Do you remember the shore, Nina? He wanted to ask, though he knew she must. What color are you making my eyes?
Shh, this is difficult.
She dabbed the drops onto her fingers and held them close to his eyes. Why can't you just put them in?
Why can't you stop talking? Do you want me to blind you?
He stopped talking. Finally, she drew back, gaze roving over his features.
Brownish, she said.
Then she winked.
Like toffee.
What do you intend to do about Bol-Yul Bayur? She straightened and stepped away, her expression shuddering.
What do you mean?
He was sorry to see her easy manner go, but that didn't matter. He glanced over his shoulder to make sure no one was listening. You know exactly what I mean. I don't believe for a second you'll let these people hand Bol-Yul Bayur over to the Kirch Merchant Council. She put the bottle back in one of the little drawers.
We'll have to do this at least two more times before we get to the ice court so I can deepen the color. Get your things together. Kaz wants us ready to leave on the hour.
She snapped the top of the case closed and picked up the shackles. Then she was gone. By the time they bid their goodbyes to the ship's crew, the sky had turned from pink to gold.
See you in Jerholm Harbor, Specht called. No mourners.
No funerals,
the others replied. Strange people. Brekker had been frustratingly tight-lipped about how exactly they were going to reach Bol-Yul Bayur and then get out of the ice court with the scientist in tow, but he'd been clear that once they had their prize, the Ferroleend was their escape route. It had papers bearing the Kurt seal and indicating that all fees and applications had been made for representatives of the Hanrot Bay Company to transport furs and goods from Fjerda to Zierfort, a port city in South Kirch. They began the march from the rocky shore up the cliffside. Spring was coming, but ice was still thick on the ground, and it was a tough climb. When they reached the top of the cliff, they stopped to catch their breath. The Ferroleend was still visible on the horizon, its sails full of the wind that whipped at their cheeks.
Saints, said Inej, we're actually doing this.
I've spent every minute of every miserable day wishing to be off that ship, said Jesper.
So why do I suddenly miss it?
Wyland stamped his boots.
Maybe because it already feels like our feet are going to freeze off.
When we get our money, you can burn Kruga to keep you warm, said Kaz. Let's go.
He'd left his crow's head cane aboard the Ferroleend and substituted a less conspicuous walking stick. Jesper had mournfully left behind his prized pearl-handled revolvers in favor of a pair of unornamented guns, and Inej had done the same with her extraordinary set of knives and daggers, keeping only those she could bear to part with when they entered the prison. Practical choices, but Matthias knew that talismans had their power. Jesper consulted his compass, and they turned south, seeking a path that would lead them to the main trading road.
I'm going to pay someone to burn my Kruga for me.
Kaz fell into step beside him.
Why don't you pay someone else to pay someone to burn your Kruger for you? That's what the big players do. You know what the really big bosses do? They pay someone to pay someone to...
Their voices trailed off as they tromped ahead, and Matthias and the others followed after. But he noticed that each of them cast a final backward glance at the vanishing Ferrolind. The schooner was a part of Kerch, a piece of home for them, and that last familiar thing was drifting farther away with every moment. Matthias felt some small measure of sympathy, but as they trekked through the morning, he had to admit he enjoyed seeing the canal rats shiver and struggle a bit for once. They thought they knew cold, but the White North had a way of forcing strangers to reevaluate their terms. They stumbled and staggered, awkward in their new boots, trying to find the trick of walking in hard-crusted snow, and soon Matthias was in the lead, setting the pace, though Jesper kept a steady eye on his compass. "Put your..." Matthias paused and had to gesture to Wylan. He didn't know the Kerch word for goggles, or even snow, for that matter. They weren't terms that came up in prison. "Keep your eyes covered, or you could damage them permanently." Men went blind this far north. They lost lips, ears, noses, hands, and feet. The land was barren and brutal, and that was all most people saw. But to Matthias, it was beautiful. The ice bore the spirit of Jell. It had color and shape and even a scent if you knew to seek it out. He pushed ahead, feeling almost at peace, as if here Jell could hear him and ease his troubled mind. The ice brought back memories of childhood, of hunting with his father. They'd lived farther south, near Halmhend, but in the winters that part of Fjerda didn't look much different from this, a world of white and gray, broken by groves of black-limbed trees and jutting clusters of rock that seemed to have risen up from nowhere, shipwrecks on a bare ocean floor. The first day trekking was like a cleansing. Little talk, the white hush of the north welcoming Matthias back without judgment. He'd expected more complaints, but even Wylan had simply put his head down and walked. "They're all survivors," Matthias understood. "They adapt." When the sun began to set, they ate their rations of dried beef and hardtack and collapsed into their tents without a word. But the next morning brought an end to the quiet and Matthias' fragile sense of peace. Now that they were off the ship and away from its crew, Kaz was ready to dig into the details of the plan.
"If we get this right, we're going to be in and out of the ice court before the Fjerdans even know their prize scientist is gone," Kaz said, as they shouldered their packs and continued to push south. "When we enter the prison, we'll be taken to the holding area beneath the men's and women's cell blocks to await charges. If Matthias is right and the procedures are still the same, the patrols only pass through the holding cells 3 times a day for headcounts. Once we're out of the cells, we should have at least 6 hours to cross to the embassy, locate Yul Bayur on the White Island, and get him down to the harbor before they realize anyone is gone."
"What about the other prisoners in the holding cells?" Matthias asked.
"We have that covered."
Matthias scowled, but he wasn't particularly surprised. Once they were in those holding cells, Kaz and the others would be at their most vulnerable. It would take only a word to the guards for Matthias to put an end to all their scheming. That was what Brum would do, what an honorable man would choose. Some part of Matthias had believed that coming back to Fjerda would return him to his senses, give him the strength to forsake this mad quest. Instead, it had only made his longing for home, for the life he'd once lived among his Druskele brothers, more acute.
"Once we're out of the cells," Kaz continued, "Matthias and Jesper will secure rope from the stables while Wylan and I get Nina and Inej out of the women's holding area. The basement is our meat. That's where the incinerator is, and no one should be in the laundry after the prison shuts down for the night. While Inej makes the climb, Wylan and I scour the laundry for anything he can use for demo.
And just in case the Fjerdens decided to stash Bo Yule by Ewer in the prison and make life easy on us, Nina, Matthias, and Jesper will search the top-level cells. Nina and Matthias? Jesper asked. Far be it for me to doubt anyone's professionalism, but is that really the ideal pairing? Matthias spit down on his anger. Jesper was right, but he hated being discussed in this way. Matthias knows prison procedure, and Nina can handle any guards without a noisy fight. Your job is to keep them from killing each other. Because I'm the diplomat of the group? There is no diplomat of the group. Now listen, Kaz said. The rest of the prison isn't like the holding area. Patrols in the cell block rotate every 2 hours, and we don't want to risk anyone sounding an alarm, so be smart. We coordinate everything to the chiming of the elder clock. We're out of the cells right after 6 bells. We're up the incinerator and on the roof by 8 bells. No exceptions.
And then what? Asked Wylan.
We cross to the embassy sector roof and get access to the glass bridge through there.
We'll be on the other side of the checkpoints, said Matthias, unable to keep a hint of admiration from his voice. The guards on the bridge will assume we passed through the embassy gate and had our papers scrutinized there. Wylan frowned.
In prison uniforms?
Phase 2, said Jesper. The fake. That's right, said Kaz. Inej, Nina, Matthias, and I will borrow a change of clothes from one of the delegations, and a little something extra for our friend Bo Yule Bayur when we find him, and stroll across the glass bridge. We locate Yule Bayur and get him back to the embassy. Nina, if there's time, you'll tailor him as much as possible, but as long as we don't trigger any alarms, no one is going to notice one more shoe among the guests.
Unless Matthias managed to get to the scientist first. If he was dead when the others found him, Kaz couldn't hold Matthias responsible. He'd still get his pardon. And if he never managed to separate from the group, a shipboard accident might still befall Yule Bayur on the journey back.
So what I'm getting from this, said Jesper, is that I'm stuck with Wylan. Unless you've suddenly acquired an encyclopedic knowledge of the White Island, the ability to pick locks, scale unscalable walls, or flirt confidential information out of high-level officials, yes. Besides, I want 2 sets of hands making bombs.
Jesper looked mournfully at his guns.
Such potential wasted.
Nina crossed her arms.
Let's say this all works. How do we get out?
We walk, Kaz said.
That's the beauty of this plan. Remember what I said about guiding the Mark's attention? At the embassy gate, all eyes will be focused on guests coming into the ice court. People leaving aren't a security risk.
Then why the bombs? Asked Wylan.
Precautions. There are 7 miles of road between the ice court and the harbor. If someone notices Bo Yule Bayur is missing, we're going to have to cover that territory fast.
He drew a line in the snow with his walking stick.
The main road crosses a gorge. We blow the bridge. No one can follow.
Matthias put his head in his hands, imagining the havoc these low creatures were about to wreak on his country's capital.
It's 1 prisoner, Helvar, said Kaz.
And a bridge, Wylan put in helpfully.
And anything we have to blow up in between, added Jesper.
Everyone shut up, Matthias growled. Jesper shrugged.
Fjerdens.
I don't like any of this, said Nina.
Kaz raised a brow.
Well, at least you and Helvar found something to agree on.
Farther south they traveled, the coast long gone, the ice broken more and more by slashes of forest, glimpses of black earth and animal tracks, proof of the living world, the heart of Jell beating always. The questions from the others were ceaseless.
How many guard towers are on the White Island again?
Do you think Yule Bayur will be in the palace?
There are guard barracks on the White Island. What if he's in the barracks?
Jesper and Wylan debated which kinds of explosives might be assembled from the prison laundry supplies, and if they could get their hands on some gunpowder in the embassy sector.
Nina tried to help Inej estimate what her pace would have to be to scale the incinerator shaft with enough time to secure the rope and get the others to the top. They drilled each other constantly on the architecture and procedures of the court, the layout of the Ringwall's 3 gatehouses, each built around a courtyard.
First checkpoint?
4 guards.
Second checkpoint?
8 guards.
Ringwall gates?
4 when the gate is non-operational.
They were like a maddening chorus of crows, squawking in Matthias' ear. Traitor, traitor, traitor.
Yellow protocol? Asked Kaz.
Sector disturbance, said Inej.
Red protocol?
Sector breach.
Black protocol?
We're all doomed? Said Jesper.
That about covers it, Matthias said, pulling his hood tighter and trudging ahead. They'd even made him imitate the different patterns of the bells, a necessity, but he'd felt like a fool chanting, Bing bong, bing bong, no wait, bing bing bong, bing bing.
When I'm rich, Jesper said behind him, I'm going someplace I never have to see snow again. What about you, Weiland?
I don't know exactly.
I think you should buy a golden piano, flute, and play concerts on a pleasure barge. You can park it in the canal right outside your father's house.
Nina can sing,
Inej put in.
We'll duet,
Nina amended.
Your father will have to move.
She did have a terrible singing voice. He hated that he knew that, but he couldn't resist glancing over his shoulder. Nina's hood had fallen back, and the thick waves of her hair had escaped her collar. Why do I keep doing that? He thought in a rush of frustration. It had happened aboard the ship, too. He'd tell himself to ignore her, and the next thing he knew, his eyes would be seeking her out. But it was foolish to pretend that she wasn't in his mind. He and Nina had walked this same territory together. If his calculations were right, they'd washed up only a few miles from where the Farolene had put into shore. It had started with a storm, and in a way, that storm had never ended. Nina had blown into his life with the wind and rain and set his world spinning. He'd been off balance ever since. The storm had come out of nowhere, tossing the ship like a toy on the waves. The sea had played along until it had tired of the game and dragged their boat under in a tangle of rope and sail and screaming men. Matthias remembered the darkness of the water, the terrible cold, the silence of the deep. The next thing he knew, he was spitting up salt water, gasping for breath. Someone had an arm around his chest, and they were moving through the water. The cold was unbearable, yet somehow he was bearing it.
"Wake up, you miserable lump of muscle!"
Clean Fjärden, pure, spoken like a noble. He turned his head and was shocked to see that the young witch they'd captured on the southern coast of the Wandering Isle had hold of him and was muttering to herself in Rovkin. He'd known she wasn't really Kalish. Somehow, she'd gotten free of her bonds and the cages. Every part of him went into panic, and if he'd been less shocked or numb, he would have struggled.
Move, she told him in Fjärden, panting. Saints, what do they feed you? You weigh about as much as a hay cart.
She was struggling badly, swimming for both of them. She'd saved his life. Why? He shifted in her arms, kicking his legs to help drive them forward. To his surprise, he heard her give a low sob.
Thank the saints, she said. Swim, you giant oaf.
Where are we? He asked.
I don't know,
she replied, and he could hear the terror in her voice. He kicked away from her.
Don't, she cried. Don't let go!
But he shoved hard, breaking her hold. The moment he left her arms, the cold rushed in. The pain was sharp and sudden, and his limbs went sluggish. She'd been using her sick magic to keep him warm. He reached for her in the dark.
Drudja,
he called, ashamed of the fear in his voice. It was the Fjärden word for witch, but he had no name for her.
Druskela,
she shouted, and then he felt his fingers brush against hers in the black water. He grabbed hold and drew her to him. Her body didn't feel warm, exactly, but as soon as they made contact, the pain in his own limbs receded. He was gripped by gratitude and revulsion.
"We have to find land," she gasped. "I can't swim and keep both of our hearts beating."
"I'll swim," he said. "You... I'll swim."
He clasped her back to his chest, his arm looped under hers and across her body, the way she'd been holding him only moments ago, as if she were drowning. And she was, they both were, or they would be soon if they didn't freeze to death first. He kicked his legs steadily, trying not to expend too much energy. But they both knew it was probably futile. They hadn't been far from land when the storm had hit, but it was completely dark. They might be headed toward the coastline or farther out to sea. There was no sound but their breathing, the slosh of the water, the roll of the waves. He kept them moving, though they might well have been paddling in a circle, and she kept both of them breathing. Which one of them would give out first, he didn't know.
"Why did you save me?" he asked finally.
"Stop wasting energy. Don't talk."
"Why did you do it?"
"Because you're a human being," she said angrily.
Lies. If they did make land, she'd need a Fjerdin to help her survive, someone who knew the land, though clearly she knew the language. Of course she did. They were all deceivers and spies, trained to prey on people like him, people without their unnatural gifts. They were predators. He continued to kick, but the muscles in his legs were tiring, and he could feel the cold creeping in on him.
"Giving up already, witch?"
He felt her shake off her exhaustion, and blood rushed back into his fingers and toes.
"I'll match your pace, Thruskella. If we die, it will be your burden to bear in the next life."
He had to smile a little at that. She certainly didn't lack for spine. That much had been clear even when she was caged. That was the way they went on that night, taunting each other whenever one of them faltered. They knew only the sea, the ice, the occasional splash that might have been a wave or something hungry moving toward them in the water.
"Look,"
the witch whispered when dawn came, rosy and blithe. There, in the distance, he could just make out a jutting promontory of ice and the blessed black slash of a dark gravel shore. Land. They wasted no time on relief or celebration. The witch tilted her head back, resting it against his shoulder as he drove forward, inch by miserable inch, each wave pulling them back, as if the sea was unwilling to relinquish its hold. At last, their feet touched bottom, and they were half swimming, half crawling to shore. They broke apart, and Matthias' body flooded with misery as he dragged himself over the black rocks to the dead and frozen land. Walking was impossible at first. Both of them moved in fits and starts, trying to get their limbs to obey, shuddering with cold. Finally, he made it to his feet. He thought about just walking off, finding shelter without her. She was on her hands and knees, head bent, her hair a wet and tangled mess covering her face. He had the distinct sense that she was going to lie down and simply not get back up. He took one step, then another, then he turned back. Whatever her reasons, she'd saved his life last night, not once, but again and again. That was a blood debt. He staggered back to her and offered his hand. When she looked up at him, the expression on her face was a bleak map of loathing and fatigue. In it, he saw the shame that came with gratitude, and he knew that in this brief moment, she was his mirror. She didn't want to owe him anything either. He could make the decision for her. He owed her that much. He reached down and yanked her to her feet, and they limped together off the beach. They headed what Matthias hoped was west. The sun could play tricks on your senses this far north, and they had no compass with which to navigate. It was almost dark, and Matthias had begun to feel the stirrings of real panic when they finally spotted the first of the whaling camps. It was deserted. The outposts were only active in the spring, and little more than a round lodge made of bone, sod, and animal skins. But shelter meant they might at least survive the night. The door had no lock. They practically fell through it.
Thank you.
She groaned as she collapsed beside the circular hearth. He said nothing. Finding the camp had been mere luck. If they'd washed up even a few miles farther up the coast, they would have been done for. The whalers had left peat and dry kindling in the hearth. Matthias labored over the fire, trying to get it to do more than smoke. He was clumsy and tired and hungry enough that he would have gladly gnawed the leather off his boot. When he heard a rustling behind him, he turned and almost dropped the piece of driftwood he'd been using to coax the little flames.
"What are you doing?"
he barked. She had glanced over her shoulder, her very bare shoulder, and said,
"Is there something I'm supposed to be doing?"
"Put your clothes back on."
She rolled her eyes.
"I'm not going to freeze to death to preserve your sense of modesty."
He gave the fire a stern jab, but she ignored him and stripped off the rest of her clothes, tunic, trousers, even her underthings, then wrapped herself in one of the grimy reindeer skins that had been piled near the door.
"Saints, this smells,"
she grumbled, shuffling over and assembling a nest of the few other pelts and blankets beside the fire. Every time she moved, the reindeer cloak parted, revealing a flash of round calf, white skin, the shadow between her breasts. It was deliberate. He knew it. She was trying to rattle him. He needed to focus on the fire. He'd almost died. And if he didn't get a fire started, he still might. If only she would stop making so much damn noise. The driftwood snapped in his hands. Nina snorted and lay down in the nest of pelts, propping herself on one elbow.
"For saints' sake, Druskella, what's wrong with you? I just wanted to be warm. I promise not to ravish you in your sleep."
"I'm not afraid of you," he said irritably. Her grin was vicious.
"Then you're as stupid as you look."
He stayed crouching beside the fire. He knew he was meant to lie down next to her. The sun had set, and the temperature was dropping. He was struggling to keep his teeth from chattering, and they would need each other's warmth to get through the night. It shouldn't have concerned him, but he didn't want to be near her. "Because she's a killer," he told himself. "That's why. She's a killer and a witch." He forced himself to rise and stride toward the blankets, but Nina held out a hand to stop him.
"Don't even think about getting near me in those clothes. You're soaked through."
"You can keep our blood flowing."
"I'm exhausted," she said angrily. "And once I fall asleep, all we'll have is that fire to keep us warm. I can see you're shaking from here. Are all Fjerdans this prudish?"
No. Maybe. He didn't really know.
The Druskell were a holy order. They were meant to live chastely until they took wives. Good Fjerdan wives who didn't run around yelling at people and taking their clothes off.
"Are all Grisha so immodest?" he asked defensively.
"Boys and girls train side by side together in the first and second armies. There isn't a lot of room for maidenly blushing."
"It's not natural for women to fight."
"It's not natural for someone to be as stupid as he is tall, and yet there you stand. Did you really swim all those miles just to die in this hut?"
"It's a lodge, and you don't know that we swam miles."
Nina blew out an exasperated breath and curled up on her side, burrowing as close as she could get to the fire.
"I'm too tired to argue."
She closed her eyes.
"I can't believe your face is going to be the last thing I see before I die."
He felt like she was daring him. Matthias stood there feeling foolish and hating her for making him feel that way. He turned his back on her and quickly sloughed off his sodden clothes, spreading them beside the fire. He glanced once at her to make sure she wasn't looking, then strode to the blankets and wriggled in behind her, still trying to keep his distance.
"Closer, Druskella,"
she crooned, taunting. He threw an arm over her, hooking her back against his chest. She let out a startled oof and shifted uneasily.
"Stop moving," he muttered.
He'd been close to girls, not many, it was true, but none of them had been like her. She was indecently round.
"You're cold and clammy,"
she complained with a shiver.
It's like lying next to a burly squid.
You told me to get closer.
He's up a bit, she instructed, and when he did, she flipped over to face him.
What are you doing? He asked, pulling back in a panic.
Relax, Druskala. This isn't where I have my way with you.
His blue eyes narrowed. I hate the way you talk. Did he imagine the hurt that flashed across her face? As if his words could have any effect on this witch. She confirmed he'd been imagining things when she said,
Do you think I care what you like or don't like?
She laid her hands on his chest, focusing on his heart. He shouldn't let her do this, shouldn't show his weakness, but as his blood began to flow and his body warmed, the relief and ease that coursed through him felt too good to resist. He let himself relax slightly, grudgingly, beneath her palms. She flipped over and pulled his arm back around her.
You're welcome, you big idiot.
He'd lied. He did like the way she talked. He still did. He could hear her yammering to Inej somewhere behind him, trying to teach her Fjärden words.
No, Hringala. You have to hang on the last syllable a bit.
Hringala?
Tried Inej.
Better, but here, it's like Kirch is a gazelle. It hops from word to word, she pantomimed. Fjärden is like gulls, all swoops and dives.
Her hands became birds riding currents on the air. At that moment, she looked up and caught him staring. He cleared his throat.
Do not eat the snow, he counseled. It will only dehydrate you and lower your body temperature.
He plunged forward, eager to be up the next hill, with some distance between them. But as he came over the rise, he halted dead in his tracks. He turned around, holding out his arms.
Stop! You don't want to!
But it was too late. Nina clapped her hands over her mouth. Inej made some kind of warding sign in the air. Jesper shook his head, and Wylan gagged. Kaz stood like a stone, his expression inscrutable. The pyre had been made on a bluff. Whoever was responsible had tried to build the fire in the shelter of a rock outcropping, but it hadn't been enough to keep the flames from dying out in the wind. Three stakes had been driven into the icy ground, and three charred bodies were bound to them, their blackened, cracked skin still smoldering.
Gazin,
swore Wylan.
What is this? This is what Fjärdens do to Grisha,
Nina said. Her face was slack, her green eyes staring.
It's what criminals do, said Matthias, his insides churning. The pyres have been illegal since...
Nina whirled on him and shoved his chest hard.
Don't you dare,
she seethed, fury burning like a halo around her.
Tell me the last time someone was prosecuted for putting a Grisha to the flames. Do you even call it murder when you put down dogs?
Nina.
Do you have a different name for killing when you wear a uniform to do it?
They heard it then, a moan, like a creaking wind.
Saints, Jesper said. One of them is alive.
The sound came again, thin and keening, from the black hulk of the body on the far right. It was impossible to tell if the shape was male or female. Its hair had burned away, its clothing fused to its limbs. Black flakes of skin had peeled away in places, showing raw flesh. A sob tore from Nina's throat. She raised her hands, but she was shaking too badly to use her power to end the creature's suffering. She turned her tear-filled eyes to the others.
I... Please, someone...
Jesper moved first. Two shots rang out, and the body fell silent. Jesper returned his pistols to their holsters.
Damn it, Jesper, Kaz growled. You just announced our presence for miles.
So they think we're a hunting party.
You should have let Inej do it.
I didn't want to do it,
Inej said quietly.
Thank you, Jesper.
Kaz's jaw ticked, but he said nothing more.
Thank you,
Nina choked out. She plunged ahead over the frozen ground, following the shape of the path through the snow. She was weeping, stumbling over the terrain. Matthias followed.
There were few landmarks here, and it was easy to get turned around. Nina, you mustn't stray from the group.
That's what you're going back to, Helvar, she said harshly. That's the country you long to serve. Does it make you proud?
I've never sent a Grisha to the pyre. Grisha are given a fair trial. She turned on him, goggles up, tears frozen on her cheeks.
Then why has a Grisha never been found innocent at the end of your supposedly fair trials? Because our crime is existing. Our crime is what we are.
Matthias went quiet, and when he spoke, he was caught between shame for what he was about to say and the need to speak the words he'd been raised on, the words that still rang true for him. Nina, has it ever occurred to you that maybe you weren't meant to exist? Nina's eyes glinted green fire. She took a step toward him, and he could feel the rage radiating off her.
Maybe you're the ones who shouldn't exist, Helvar. Weak and soft, with your short lives and your sad little prejudices. You worship wood sprites and ice spirits who can't be bothered to show themselves, but you see real power, and you can't wait to stamp it out.
Don't mock what you don't understand.
My mockery offends you? My people would welcome your laughter in place of this barbarity.
A look of supreme satisfaction crossed her face.
Ravka is rebuilding. So is the Second Army, and when they do, I hope they give you the fair trial you deserve. I hope they put the Druskella in shackles and make them stand to hear their crimes enumerated so the world will have an accounting of your evils.
If you're so desperate to see Ravka rise, why aren't you there now?
I want you to have your pardon, Helvar. I want you to be here when the Second Army marches north and overruns every inch of this wasteland. I hope they burn your fields and salt the earth. I hope they send your friends and your family to the pyre.
They already did, Zenik. My mother, my father, my baby sister. Inferni soldiers, your precious, persecuted Grisha, burned our village to the ground. I have nothing left to lose. Nina's laugh was bitter.
Maybe your stay in Hellgate was too short, Matthias. There's always more to lose.
20. Nina. I can smell them. Nina batted at her hair and clothes as she lurched through the snow, trying not to retch. She couldn't stop seeing those bodies. The angry red flesh peeking through their burnt black casings like banked coals. It felt like she was coated in their ashes, in the stink of burning flesh. She couldn't take a full breath. Being around Matthias made it easy to forget what he really was, what he really thought of her. She'd tailored him again just this morning, enduring his glowers and grumbling. No, enjoying them. Grateful for the excuse to be near him. Ridiculously pleased every time she brought him close to a laugh. Saints, why do I care? Why did one smile from Matthias Helvar feel like 50 from someone else? She'd felt his heart race when she'd tipped his head back to work on his eyes. She'd thought about kissing him. She'd wanted to kiss him. And she was pretty sure he'd been thinking the same thing. Or maybe he was thinking about strangling me again. She hadn't forgotten what he'd said aboard the Feralind. When he'd asked what she intended to do about Bo-Yul Bajor, if she truly meant to hand the scientist over to the Kirch. If she sabotaged Kaz's mission, would it cost Matthias his pardon? She couldn't do that. No matter what he was, she owed him his freedom. 3 weeks she'd traveled with Matthias after the shipwreck. They hadn't had a compass, hadn't known where they were going. They hadn't even known where on the northern shore they'd washed up. They'd spent long days slogging through the snow, freezing nights in whatever rudimentary shelter they could assemble, or in the deserted huts of whaling camps when they were lucky enough to come across them. They'd eaten roasted seaweed and whatever grasses or tubers they could find. When they found a stash of dried reindeer meat at the bottom of a travel pack in one of the camps, it had been like some kind of miracle. They'd gnawed on it in mute bliss, feeling nearly drunk on its flavor. After the first night, They'd slept in all the dry clothes and blankets they could find, but on opposite sides of the fire. If they didn't have wood or kindling, they curled against one another, barely touching. But by morning, they'd be pressed together, breathing in tandem, cocooned in muzzy sleep. A single crescent moon. Every morning, he complained that she was impossible to wake.